It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Today, it's our special year-end show, 2015, looking back, looking ahead, as we review the significant events that have shaped our lives in the past year. In this segment, we're looking back at state and regional stories. I'm joined now by phone by our Capitol correspondent, Mary Wilson, with us from Harrisburg. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
Also joining us is opinions editor for the Harrisburg Patriot News and Penn Live, John Misek, also on the line from Harrisburg. Hello, John.
Paul, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Well, no discussion of state issues in 2015 could begin with anything other than the state budget crisis that the state of Pennsylvania spent half a year enduring. And I'm wondering how we got here. What are the factors that have created this half-year stalemate? And I'll start first with you, John Misek.
First, there was an enormous explosion, and then the earth cooled. And I'm sorry, that's going too far back. Though it does seem that way at times. Yeah, well, this is just, you know, it's my 17th budget. It's the most extraordinary thing I think I've ever seen. Back in March of this year, Governor Tom Wolf, a Democrat, rolled out his budget proposal to the General Assembly, a $34 billion plan that called for a severance tax, an expansion of the state's personal income tax, an expansion of the state's sales tax, new increases for public education and higher education, and a host of other programs. The legislature immediately put its hand up and said, no freaking way, and they were off to the races. By June, the Senate had sent them their own version of the budget, saying they weren't going to go for Wolf's spending and tax increases. The governor, for the first time, and Mary can correct me on this, in 40-something years since Milton Schaaf vetoed the entire shooting match. And, you know, that began, and thus began the current stalemate.
And so it's been a real battle, and we seem to be seeing increased polarization. Mary Wilson, we've talked about this with you on the program, that you have two sides, divided government, a Democratic governor, a Republican-controlled legislature, very different philosophies, and two very entrenched entities here, which has created the chemistry for what we've seen during the second half of 2015.
Right. I mean, we're seeing, you know, in the state legislature what we see across the country, which is districts that are drawn to be safe seats for both sides of the aisle, preserving Democratic numbers and preserving Republican numbers, sometimes, you know, along the margins, helping Republicans boost their majority. But for the most part, encouraging members on either side of the aisle to grow more extreme because they're protecting themselves. Their biggest threat is not a general election challenger, but a primary election challenger. So you've got that trend playing out at the state level, as it is at the national level. You've got kind of a difference. This is something I don't tend to think about that much because I wasn't around before the pay raise, but Misek can speak to this. Membership, the rank-and-file members of the Capitol are not the members of yesteryear. They are not so interested in, you know, doing the bidding of their leaders. The leaders of the various caucuses don't have as much power as they used to over the political rise and fall of these members. So there's much more potential for volatility. There's much more potential for, you know, factions to break out within the House Republicans or the House Democrats, and likewise in the Senate. So you've got that going on. You've got kind of an unpredictable trajectory of the different caucuses, and a really big challenge when it comes to marshaling all those different people, all those votes. And I guess so. Those are just two trends I would point out.
And John, you know, you have Governor Wolf, who's a Democrat, and he's favored additional funds for education, and that's, he stated as far back as March that this was a priority. This was something he was going to fall on his sword for, if necessary, to get done. In the meantime, on the other side, Republicans who have resisted higher taxes to pay for it, and this is something that they feel is the mandate that they have received from their constituents, that under no circumstances should taxes be raised. So you have extremely divided government, two sides that have firmly held philosophical beliefs, polar opposites in some respect. How much have you seen this factor into what we've seen in Harrisburg this year?
Well, I mean, keep in mind, Paul, I mean, we even have, within divided government, we have sub-divided government, because you have these certain Republicans cutting a deal with the administration for a so-called budget framework back in November that actually included an expansion of Pennsylvania's 6% sales tax. Not the rate, mind, but the base. Things that had been previously exempted from the sales tax were going to be included, like concert tickets and the digital downloads and that kind of stuff. And then there's this late-breaking package where there was an expansion of the personal income tax as well. And that hit a brick wall in the state house where conservative members were dead set against voting for any tax increase of any kind. Whereas you had this four-party agreement between House and Senate Democrats, Senate Republicans, and the administration that this was the best way to go. I mean, so not only is there, you know, division between Democrats and Republicans on the way forward, there's division between House and Senate Republicans on the best way forward. I mean, so you have polarization, and then there's sort of like this sub-polarization within the polarization, and the dynamic is just extraordinary.
Well, I think what you're talking about here, and either of you, I'll let you both chime in on this. I'm sure you're familiar with pollster Terry Madonna of Franklin and Marshall College. He said that, in his opinion, we have in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania the most conservative legislature in modern history, and that many Republican legislative members were elected on no tax pledges and come from, as you have alluded to, heavily gerrymandered districts. So, you know, you add to that mix someone who could, I think, fairly be described as a liberal governor, Governor Wolf. There's a really interesting dynamic here, and it speaks to what you were talking about earlier, John, about how you have this divided government within the Republican Party of really conservative legislative members who Terry Madonna has characterized as, you know, part of the most conservative legislature in modern history. Would you say that is a fair comment to make?
Well, I mean, yeah, absolutely. Mary touched on this a couple of minutes ago. The composition of legislature changed after 2005 when they kicked out a lot of the views as sort of the overly accommodating Republican lawmakers who had led to that pay grab. And that trend has only continued through cycles, particularly in 2010 with the big Republican sweeps of that year. And Republicans have only gained, they now, I think, have their largest margin in the state house in 50-something years. Their margin has grown in the state Senate as well. And the members who have been elected have been much more deeply ideologically entrenched, reflecting trends nationally as well. So, yeah, that's absolutely a fair comment by my friend Terry.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and this is our year-end special 2015, Looking Back, Looking Ahead. In this segment, we're reviewing state and regional stories with our Capitol correspondent, Mary Wilson, as well as John Misick, opinions editor for the Harrisburg Patriot News and Penn Live. And had it not been for the budget crisis, I think news that has surrounded Attorney General Kathleen Kane in 2015 would have probably taken the cake as the top story. And maybe in some people's list of top 10 stories, this may, in fact, end up topping the list. And just when it seemed that this story couldn't get stranger or more complicated, there has been news in the past week that Kathleen Kane, that two of her agents have filed a federal lawsuit accusing her of urging them to lie to disrupt a grand jury probe. I read this first on the Penn Live website, John, so I'll let you kind of explain what this new wrinkle to an already bizarre story.
I've actually called for a moratorium, Paul, on the phrase just when you thought it could not get any weirder in relation to Kathleen Kane, because we seem to plumb new depths every single time. But yeah, you're correct. Two of Kane's former agents filed a federal lawsuit in Harrisburg just the other week, claiming that the Attorney General ordered them to lie to the grand jury that was investigating her. It's on top of another federal lawsuit that's been filed for retaliation. The Attorney General herself, as we well know, has had her law license suspended by the state Supreme Court and faces charges of perjury and other counts in relation to her allegedly lying to a grand jury. And then on and on and on it goes. So this is just the latest wrinkle in that saga.
This year, the Patriot News called for her resignation, and She hasn't responded, John.
Yeah, three times, in fact.
Mary Wilson, how is it that Kathleen Kane has been able to stay in office, and how would you say she's been able to continue, you know, functioning as the Attorney General, which, you know, she's still in her office. She's still doing something in there.
Well, exactly what she's able to do is what she's able to do legally is still a matter that's up for some debate. And it received a lot of scrutiny when the state Senate began the process of considering ousting her. They hauled in her top deputies. They hauled in legal experts and said, you know, the law that we have to go on says that the state attorney general must be a member of the bar. What does that mean in terms of her law license? If she doesn't have an active law license, she's still a member of the bar because she hasn't been disbarred. So what can she do and what can't she do? There's a lot of tussling over that still. She has been able to remain in her office basically by putting up a fight and saying, look, I deserve a trial. This is Kane. In Kane, if Kane were here, I think she would say, I deserve a trial. I deserve, you know, to be given the benefit of the, you know, to be able to prove my case. The arguments from people who counter that, including fellow Democrats like Governor Tom Wolf, they say, well, you can't both be the top law enforcement official of the state and manage this office and also, you know, bring your best case and consider, you know, the various, you know, the criminal case against her. There are multiple now. Misek mentioned one of them. There are multiple cases from former colleagues and former employees against her. So it is quite a tangle.
And hasn't one of her defenses in refusing to resign been that, you know, we come back to the mandate again, that she won an election by overwhelming numbers. Granted, it was now almost 4 years ago. But she's saying that, you know, I wasn't appointed. The people put me here.
Right.
And that's kind of been her mantra, hasn't it?
Right. Exactly right. You know, her argument is that it's a far graver to oust someone who's been, you know, who's a democratically elected official. The people, she says, wanted her in this role, and she is going to fulfill her obligation to them.
John, so what do you see happening? I mean, the Senate, they seem to be proceeding with the utmost caution here, that they would seemingly have more than enough grounds to find a way to remove her, but they don't. For some reason, they don't seem to be moving aggressively toward that. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's for the very reason that Mary mentioned, Paul. I mean, this is a democratically small, the elected official who actually outpolled Barack Obama in 2012. And they are relying on constitutional language that hasn't been employed since the 1890s. And it's not like anybody left an instruction book behind on how best to do this. They're kind of flying blind. So it's a hugely politically sensitive matter. Kane herself has said, well, fine, if you're going to try to remove me, it ought not to be until I am convicted. And in addition, if you are going to, it should be through the traditional method of impeachment, which requires conviction by the House and a trial in the state Senate, which by design is a difficult and cumbersome process because, again, this is somebody who was duly elected, and undoing the results of an election is no small thing.
Do you both see her, and I know, you know, Mary, you've thrown your crystal ball away, at least when it comes to budget issues, but in terms of the Kathleen Kane issue, do you see her staying in office for the remainder of her term until and unless... And I guess the other question is, do you see her, is she officially said she's going to even run for re-election at this point?
Kane has said she intends to run for re-election, but she's also acknowledged that the fact that she doesn't have a law license makes it awfully difficult for her to run for re-election. What with the Constitution saying that the Attorney General must be a licensed attorney in order to hold the gig. So it's a bit of a thing.
And Mary, do you see her staying in office for the remainder of her term?
You know, I really don't know. You know, like you say, I've really stopped reading tea leaves this year. But I will say that, you know, let's play this out. The Senate is considering, you know, it's on the path to officially considering her removal. voted unanimously to go forward with that process, which means that there's going to be a hearing in which she and or her lawyers could defend her before the Senate. And then there would be a vote. The Senate would, you know, recommend to remove her or not. And then the governor, it seemed to be under the impression that he would be charged with, you know, doing what the Senate suggested. Let's say all that happens and the Senate calls for Kane's ouster. What I would expect in that case is that Kane would challenge it and that this would have to be resolved by the courts. The state Supreme Court has been called before to resolve matters concerning Kane. They are very much entangled in the pornographic and offensive emails that Kane has been releasing, piecemeal in some cases. So I would think that this would have to end in court, and I don't know how long that would take. But I've already put the cart before the horse with that analysis.
Yeah, well, there's an election 10 months from now, so you would think that maybe the easiest thing to do would be to wait till then, but we'll see. So two issues that have really dominated the state and regional scene this year. Before we wrap this up, I'll give each of you a turn to mention another story or two that really deserves to be mentioned as one of the big ones from 2015. John Micek, do you have something for us? One or two things?
You know, this one's not strictly state government, but it is politics related. We had three embattled mayors in small to medium-sized cities across Pennsylvania this year. We saw Stephen R. Reed, the former mayor of Harrisburg, charged in relation to his acquisition of artifacts for a Civil War museum. Vaughn Spencer, the former mayor of Reading, stepping down amidst an FBI probe. And Ed Pulaski, the mayor of Allentown, also in the midst of the center of an FBI probe. So it was not a very good year for small city mayors either.
Well done. All right, Mary.
I hate to look back into a story that is connected to Kathleen Kane, but that's where I'm going to go. I'm going to go to that well again, because
okay.
I think the emails that Kane has released and has alluded to and has made kind of the basis of her criminal defense so far. Her office uncovered these pornographic and insensitive and offensive emails on the State Office of Attorney General servers. She has released some of them. She has not released all. But by all accounts, the emails, there's just a vast chain of people implicated on these emails. Prosecutors, judges, the emails have already brought down one state Supreme Court justice. Another one is under investigation. I think the impact here is pretty vast, and I think it could be the kind of thing that that prompts some discussion of reform within the court system. It's already prompted discussion of that. I'd be interested to see if legislation actually, you know, gains any traction to try to, in a better way, police communication between judges and lawyers, between judges and prosecutors. In some way, even trying to restore the image itself of the court, even if it's just a window dressing type thing, I would think that we're going to see that in the next year and a half or so, because the story of these, you know, raunchy emails has just so rattled the state political milieu.
Well, it's been certainly an interesting year, to say the least. And I want to thank both of you for joining us on our special look back and look ahead. Mary Wilson, who is our Capitol correspondent, and also John Micek, who is the opinions editor for the Harrisburg Patriot News and Penn Live. Thank you both for your appearances on our program throughout the year, and we'll look forward to talking to you again in 2016. Happy New Year to both of you, Mary and John.
Thank you so much. Happy New Year.
More of our special look back and look ahead at 2015 with Tony Norman, columnist for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.